Thank you, Adam. Will you join me for a moment of prayer? God, be present with us at this time. May it be your words that are spoken and your words that are heard. In your name we pray. Amen. Someone once told me that the shortest distance, or the distance from one's head to one's heart on most people is about 18 inches. About 18 inches from head to heart. And yet the journey from head to heart is perhaps the longest journey that most of us will ever undertake in our life. That in fact, most of our life is a journey, particularly if you're a person of deep spirituality, yearning for a spiritual journey, it is that journey of moving from head to heart. Understanding what is right and wrong, the journey from knowledge to the journey to wisdom and being that which is right, that which is good. For most of us, it is indeed a lifelong journey. I think one of the reasons why we are quite fascinated over time and biblical studies with King David is that he is a person that tended to go on that journey a lot, tended to think with his head or the other end of his brainstem too much, and had a hard time making his way to his heart at times, and then when he did, it overwhelmed him. Psalm 51 that Adam just read for us comes from one of those moments, we are told. It is a story that begins in 2 Samuel, in the 11th chapter, where it begins with, in the springtime when kings go to war, David was home in Jerusalem. And the writer is not saying it's because things were so peaceful that David could be in Jerusalem. It was because whereas all of his soldiers were out fighting his wars for him, he was home. And what we know from the story is while he's home, he's looking over on his lanai, and he looks over and he sees this very beautiful woman by the name of Bathsheba, who is married to Uriah the Hittite, and things get busy between the two of them, and she ends up being pregnant. He ends up finding a way to have Uriah the Hittite killed in battle. And at this point in the story, and there's more to it, but we don't have all the time in the day, but at this point, his chief advisor by the name of Nathan comes in and tells him a story about a person, a wealthy man, that takes advantage of this poor person, and David erupts in anger. Erupts in anger because David knows the law. He is the king of a kingdom that is founded upon the law that God gave to Moses and the people of Israel. He knows the law, and he knows that it is about justice, and he knows that this is a terrible act of injustice. And at that point, Nathan looks at David and says, "You, David, you are the man." And David, because he is on that journey from head to heart, instead of just staying up here and looking for ways to justify his actions, realizes the truth of what Nathan has just said, and realizes how poorly he has acted, realizes in the terrible way in which he has sinned, which he has turned away from God, turned away from the law that he is supposed to be upholding. And David utters the words of Psalm 51. "Have mercy on me, O God. According to your steadfast love, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin. Create in me a clean heart, and put a new and right spirit within me." For the people of Israel, the heart, the way that they understood this, it was the center of one's mind, the center of one's spirit, the very place in which we touched ourselves, were able to touch God. Create in me a clean heart. Create in me a new opportunity to be connected, to turn right to you, O God. For he realizes how far he has strayed from that which is right, from that which God has planted within himself. And that he recognizes in order for him to live right, he must recenter his very being on the heart of God. Now, most of us aren't king. Most of us, therefore, aren't the law as David was. Most of us, therefore, are forced to live in a world of laws. And have you ever noticed how much we don't like living in a world of laws? To a degree, we say, oh, this is good, keeps things together. But when the law is coming down upon us, we're not so happy with that external power coming at us. I began to illustrate this to eighth graders at Camp Mokulaia and many other age groups over the years with an activity called the spider's web. And the spider's web is simply something that looks like a spider's web, hence the name, strung between two trees, and it has some fairly good-sized pukas and some fairly small pukas. And the task that is given to the young people is that they are to try and get folks from one side of the spider's web to the other side of the spider's web by passing them through the spider's web. And really the only rule that I give them is that you are not allowed to touch the spider's web when you pass someone through. If their clothing, if their hair, if your hand touches the spider's web, they must come back out to the other side, start over. And you have 20 minutes. And then I tell them one other thing. And oh, by the way, I'm here to help you, but I'm not here to police you. It's up to you. You know the way that you're supposed to be. You're not supposed to touch the rope. And if you touch it, you're supposed to tell one another, I touched the rope, and you start that person over again. That's the rule. That's the law. It's up to you. Don't look to me. For the next 20 minutes, every time they touched the rope, eyes turned to me to see if I saw it. I saw nothing. For the next 20 minutes, they look at each other when they touch the rope and they say, well, was it a small touch? Was it a big touch? Can we? And at the end, we talk about this. Because what I have emphasized to them over and over and over while doing this activity, that it's really not about how many people you pass through the spider's web. It's about how well you work together and how well you obey the rules that you know. And then they have to evaluate themselves on how well they obeyed the rules, and they have to basically say, well, we weren't very good. Because they have this desire to get past the rule, this desire to complete, this desire to succeed at something that they weren't even asked to succeed on. And we begin to have a conversation at that time about that, in which I say, do you notice this in your own life at other times? And I say, how many of you would like, if you had the opportunity to get an A on a test, but cheat just a little bit, or get a B on the test and not cheat at all, how many of you would choose the A? And it is amazing, and I believe that this would be absolutely true across almost all generations. How many hands say, we would like the A? It's just a little bit of cheating, right? It's just a little. Nobody's going to really notice, and look, I get the A. That helps me get into college. That helps me get the job I want. That helps me get the career. All those things, we make those little fudges. And the reality is that most of us are just like those eighth graders, is that when there is this external law that is put upon us, we chafe against it. And if you don't think you do, next time that you're driving on the freeway and you come upon the policeman that has his speed gun out, tell me how many of you are not going to slow down immediately. And not only slow down immediately, even though you know what the speed limit is, and you know what you're supposed to do, and you know that speed limit exists because it keeps us safe. And how many of you are going to be really upset with that policeman as well? Look, he's hiding. They're hiding over there. They're trying to catch us. They're trying to trap me. We don't like the external being put upon us. On April 15th, how many of us are going to look at the taxes that we will have turned in, and how many of us will have said, is there any way I can pay less? Is there any way I can find an accountant who might find a loophole that I don't know about that might help me to be able to do this? Because I really don't like it when they're telling me that I have to give them this money that I have worked so hard for. The truth is, even the most enlightened of laws, excuse me just a minute, with even the most enlightened of laws, those that seem to encompass regulating our behavior in such a way that the entire community, even the entire creation, will flourish, will get some pushback from us. Look at the Ten Commandments. Those were good laws. They were laws that were given to the people of Israel on Mount Sinai. The Ten Commandments is a set of laws that mandate our relationship to God and to one another. Where is Liz? Liz, are you? Do you have any of those little lozenges? My lozenge keeper. It is law that Liz must have lozenges, or we call them today lozenges, Come on. It was pretty good. Thank you, Liz. You have saved my life. Ten Commandments are laws, and excuse me, I'm going to look like a chipmunk here for just a minute. There are these laws that mandate our relationship to God and to one another. Follow these laws, God says, and you will flourish. You will flourish as a community. The world will flourish as well. David, King David, tries to uphold these laws. Fails miserably time and time again, but always finds himself back, excuse me, to those laws. That's about the year 1000. Fast forward 400 years. Now we're right around 600. There have been some kings that have come and gone in David's time. Some have been good, some have been bad. The worst of which might well have been the king just around Jeremiah's time, just before 600 BCE, by the name of Amon. Actually, he wasn't the worst. His father, Manasseh, they say, might well have been the worst. It was not a good time for Israel. And one of the realities was people looked around and they saw that Israel, which had once been the golden boy of this area when David and Solomon were king, was no longer the top dog. In fact, Babylon, Assyria, Egypt, they all eyed Israel and Judah as if they were two of the 31 flavors at Baskin and Robbins. They were wanting them desperately and badly. And so there were prophets that rose up, like Jeremiah, that said, the problem is we are not adhering to the law that God has given to us. Look at Ammon. Look at Manasseh. Look at the way in which they lived. Look at the way the religious elites, the powerful people lived. And look what happened. And Jeremiah lambasts them from the streets day in and day out. People don't like him because he speaks truth to power. Don't know what's going on. Apologize. And he prays, Jeremiah prays over and over and over, that those that lead the country will have a change of ways. And his prayers seem to be answered, because Ammon dies, and his son Josiah becomes king. And in terms of good and bad kings, this is a good king, a right and just king, who discovers that somewhere hidden in the temple is a scroll, and on that scroll is what becomes to us as the book of Deuteronomy, a list of 600 more laws that help to reflect on the 10 laws of the 10 commandments and help us to understand to minor details how we shall live. If we just live by these laws, all will be well. And Josiah understands this. And Josiah begins to lead the people to become a people of the law again. And yet Babylon is hungry, and Babylon comes in and takes over Israel big time. Having the king who is adherent to the law was not enough, apparently. And the king is killed. The elite are exiled. The rest of the people are exiled. The temple is to the ground. Adherence to the law didn't seem to be enough. And I think part of that may be because the law itself is not enough. Because the law is this part, the head, and not the heart. Gus Spieth, who was an advisor to I agree. Put a muffler on them. Gus Spieth, who was an advisor to Bill Clinton, an advisor to Jimmy Carter on environmental issues, became the director of the Yale School of Forestry, just recently, talking about environmental issues, said this: I used to think the top global environmental problems were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, and climate change. I thought with 30 years of good science, we could address those problems, but I was wrong. The top environmental problems are selfishness, greed, and apathy. And to deal with these, we need a spiritual and cultural transformation. And we scientists don't know how to do that. Now, he's talking about environmental issues, but it is the same thing if we take ourselves back 2,600-ish years ago. Then the time of Josiah, even though they were trying desperately to live by this Deuteronomic code, by the Ten Commandments, the true issue there was not enough for doing this. Not enough had moved that from head to heart, and so what was really at issue were selfishness and greed and apathy. And the result of that was the nation did not stand. A spiritual transformation is what is needed. And Jeremiah understands this. So in chapter 31 of his book of prophecy, in what Adam just read to us, he says, "The day will come, says God, where I will put my law within them. I will write it in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. I will take the laws that are on stone, and I will put them in their hearts. And they will live from that place, from their heart. I shall write the law which is right and good, not on tablets of stone, not as an external force, but it shall become an internal reality. Not something that needs to be imposed, but that which we know and live into being true." And so think a moment. Think a moment about people that you know in your life that are just like what Jeremiah has described. People in your life that you know have this heart in which that which is good and that which is right is what encapsulates the whole of who they are, and they live out into it. People who have made that journey from head to heart, what are they like? What are their qualities like? As I thought about this, I flashed upon a book that I read a number of years ago, and some of you may know it as well, this book called Change We Must. How many of you read it? There's a hand up. Yay! It's a book about a wonderful woman, Nana Veery. Some of you may have known, anyone here who knew Nana Veery? Passed away in the late 1990s or so. Her daughter was Emma Veery, one of the great voices of Hawaii in the 20th century. Nana Veery was this amazing woman who lived a life, a spiritual journey. She talks about that in her book. She talks about her journey from being a person who was embraced by her Hawaiian culture, a person that was embraced by a Christian spirit, a person that went on a journey of Zen Buddhism and all sorts of other spiritual explorations to find a truth that she could live by, to live from out of her heart. And she did. And she did. And as you read this book, and I really recommend it, it's a wonderful book, happy to share it with anyone who wants it. As you read this book, she talks about some things that from the very beginning of her life helped her to understand or helped her to make that journey from head to heart. She was born pure Hawaiian to a mother who was struggling and that mother was being raised by a foster mother. Her father, her birth father, died before she was even born. So she was raised for the first 4 years of her life with her mother and her foster grandmother. And at 4 and a half, her mother dies as well. And her foster grandmother then says, "You are now mine. I shall be your mother." And in the Hawaiian tradition, as what Emma Veery talks about, is at that time, this is 1912, 1913, she says, there was no such thing as an unwanted child. There was no such thing as a child who was not loved. And foster mother, foster grandmother, didn't become mother out of obligation, became mother because this is what love does. You reach out and you create home for them. And Nana Veery talks about when she was 6 or 7 years old and she was living in their community, and there was a stranger that walked into the community, and the stranger came and knocked on their door. And the mother opened the door, her mother opened the door and invited her to come inside. And the man came inside and she fed him and gave him a meal, entertained him with conversation, and then he left. And so Nana Veery comes to her mother and says, "Mama, did you know the man?" And she says, "No, I did not." "Then why, Mama? Why did you feed him?" And her mom looks at her and says, "I was not feeding the man. I was entertaining the Spirit of God that was there within him." You lead from that heart. You lead from that heart. And Emma Veery talks about leading a life that comes from an understanding of aloha, as she understood it. Alo being from the bosom, the center of the universe. Ha, being the voice of God, so that you lead with the voice, the breath of God. You lead, you live a life in which you are filled with the breath of God that comes from the very center of the universe. How can you not live a good and wonderful and just and peaceful life if that is what will animate you and drive you? Emma Beery, in a sometimes the flow just goes the other way. Emma Beery tells a story of, as a teenager, in this home where she's living, mom and dad are sleeping in the one bedroom. She and her two siblings are sleeping in the bedroom next door. And then she hears a great commotion and her father kind of exasperated in the middle of the night, and she gets up and says, "What's going on, Dad?" And he has just tripped over 21 boys that are sleeping in the living room. Why were there 21 boys? Well, it's because Nana Beery was a woman. Her job was to run the concession stand at the natatorium. There were many people in those days that dropped off their troubled boys at the natatorium because they knew that Nana would take care of them. Nana Beery would take care of them. And every now and then, she just brought them home. And it turned out that she stayed home so often that the landlord who was renting them the house said, "You know, this just doesn't work. You need to find another place to live." And so for 2 years, their family lived at the natatorium, so that Nana Beery could take care of her boys. This was the life of a person who lives from that heart, not just from a head, not just from an external of what must be done, but an internal of what can be done. And I thought about this as I was preparing for this week, and knowing that we were going to continue with Ellen's leadership this conversation today about toxic charity. And one of the things that Ellen talked about this morning was the difference between charity and justice work, right? And one of the things that we talked about is sometimes that charity may well be what we do leading from our heart. That which is the deepest part of us just leading from our heart. And it is one side of the coin. There is another side of the coin. And every coin, if it is to have value, must in fact have two sides to it. The other side is a side of justice work, of advocacy, for making sure that there are indeed laws. Because if James Gustav Spieth is correct, that which is the real root of our issues is selfishness and greed and apathy, and throw in just a little bit of violence and a little bit of discrimination in there as well, if that is the root of our issues, then it is absolutely essential that there be people who are working so that we can indeed have a civil society to make sure that laws are passed that will keep the world just. That's why there are many of you that will be gathered next Saturday at 9:45 in the Mackay Eva corner of the rotunda, so that you can join with people from around this community, join with young people from around the country, and do that March for Our Lives. Be part of that as you've been part of other marches, because this is important that we be a people of justice and advocacy, that we be a people of the law, of making sure that there are just laws. But it is also essential. It is also essential that that work be driven not by just what is up here, but by what is in here as well. When Jeremiah says, God will write within us a new law within our hearts, we know that what we are hearing in that is God will write within us the ability to love, the ability to live out of aloha, the ability to be connected to God, to be with the Christ. And I think about what we just shared with the young people, St. Patrick's breastplate. The laws of love, the spirit of aloha, is so similar to that prayer of Christ be with me. Christ be beside me. Christ be before me. Christ be behind me. Christ be above me. Christ be below me. Christ be within me. If we are able as a people to be a people of the law, ensuring that we work to make sure that laws exist in our community that create justice and equity and peace, and we are a people of the heart that ensure that that work that we've done comes from a sense of love and aloha, a sense of Christ within us, then indeed, the world will change, the world will shift, and the God that loves us will be present every moment of every day. Amen.